Hello, this is Fight Back, a podcast by the Healthcare Consumer Rights Foundation. I'm Steve Poizner, healthcare consumer advocate, founder, and executive director. Our nonprofit's mission is to help you navigate the complex healthcare system and understand your legal rights, options, and opportunities when you encounter problems and obstacles. We want to empower you with the information you need to fight back and get the best possible care. On this Fight Back episode, our special guest, Dr. Ted Mazur, is an ear, nose, and throat specialist and named one of the top doctors in Southern California. Dr. Mazur is also a former president of the California Medical Association. He joins us to talk about how you can make your medical expenses fit into your budget. We discuss the importance of shopping around for needed medical procedures and prescription drugs, the ways to avoid surprise billing, understanding how in and out of network physicians affect your final bill, how to negotiate hospital bills, and more. Let's get started.
Thanks for tuning in to the Fight Back podcast. This is Jamie Rosales, health advocate and executive director of the Healthcare Consumer Rights Foundation. Remember, you can find all our podcasts on our website at healthcareconsumerrights.org. If you are enjoying the podcast, please consider a gift to help us keep Fight Back available. Your gift can be made at healthcareconsumerrights.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Dr. Ted Mazur, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Dr. Mazur, so it's a pleasure to talk to you again. The last time we spoke, you were president of the California Medical Association, and you have a distinguished career as well in the medical community in Southern California. So it's great to talk to you today about the topic of, you know, how consumers can take better control over the costs that they pay every day, every month here. So as you know, it can be quite frustrating for consumers just to make ends meet, number one, but just all the co-pays and deductibles and insurance premiums and insurance companies, you know, sometimes not, you know, agreeing to allow the, you know, your doctor to proceed with a procedure that they think is medically necessary. So what's your advice for consumers at a high level of how to fight back and how to, you know, make your medical expenses fit into your budget?
Well, I guess from the highest level, Steve, the answer is know what your insurance product is. Sometimes it's given to you by an employer, sometimes you choose it from a menu, and sometimes you purchase it yourself. But every one of the plans out there, whether they're HMO, PPO, something called point of service, which is a little bit of a blend, they're all different. They all have different expectations of you, the consumer, the person seeking healthcare, and different rules to play by, particularly here in California, where we're overseen by two different agencies, two different regulators, whether it's a PPO or an HMO plan, and even those don't really align with the given agency. So know your product, know what a deductible is, know what a copayment is, know that the physician, the hospital, are also under contracts, and they can't go around those contracts sometimes. If your copay is $40, your copay is $40. Your plan doesn't pay that. And also know about in-network and out-of-network benefits, because they can vastly affect your pocketbook and your ability to get through the system. It's complex, and there are ways of navigating it, but it starts with knowing what it is that you have purchased or have had purchased for you.
What's the best way, Ted, to really get fully acquainted with the kind of insurance product that you have and its coverage and the rules and regulations? Is it to talk to the HR department from the company where you're employed, or what are the other ways to learn about what you have?
Well, if you're with a large company, yes, absolutely go to HR and discuss with them what your options are and what your benefits are, particularly if you're running into a problem after seeing a physician or getting a referral. They can be very helpful because they can go to your insurer and say, hey, we got 100 employees here and we need this patient taken care of, this employee taken care of. If you're buying it on your own, sometimes you can get information from a broker. If you know the questions to ask, and there are many, you can do this on your own talking to somebody at the plan. And oftentimes a physician's office will help you navigate that. They'll have staff that will help you understand what your benefits are, what the expectations are. And if you're looking at procedures or testing, to make sure that you are going to a proper contracted facility and give you an idea what your expenses may be and how far along you are in paying your deductible. In practice, I have to tell you how many times people don't understand that a deductible is what you pay out of pocket before your plan pays for anything. And that's critically important if you're having an expensive test done or particularly a surgery done, hospitalization, because it's an unexpected bill, but it really shouldn't be unexpected. And it can't be waived. That's the problem.
So you're saying that the medical provider cannot give you any break on the deductible?
Under contract, the medical provider is not supposed to give you any discounts. Now, on a case-by-case basis, many of us do give discounts. We might say to somebody, okay, we understand you're really tight, you've had a lot of expenses, and you can waive it on a case-by-case basis. Even Medicare, under law, the provider has to collect that copayment, has to collect your deductible. But there is an allowance on a case-by-case basis. The problem here is the expectation that a lot of people have that they have a high copay and that the doctor is simply going to waive it. And without, you know, without not understanding the difficulties people have financially, I can remember days when I would call patients because I don't want to send anybody to collections, but they have a big outstanding balance and I'm still taking care of them. There's a point where I used to make calls and I learned probably not a good idea. And people would say, well, doc, can't you just write that off? And the answer is not really. Under contract and under law, you can't do that without extenuating circumstance. In some sense, it seems harsh on the physician side. People have this expectation that physicians could just write everything off. The reality is medicine doesn't work that way anymore. And if I did that for every patient who wanted their copay written off, I wouldn't pay salaries. It's just that simple.
Right. So it still makes sense, I assume, for people to think about shopping around. You know, because of the copays and the deductibles. I mean, for example, an MRI, I know of one situation where, you know, MRI at a hospital costs X dollars and across the street at a, you know, imaging center, same equipment, same radiologist, and it costs, mm-hmm. you know, half the price. So do you recommend shopping around?
Yes, absolutely. When you can, talk to your physician, talk to the staff, and say, where in my network can I go to get quality, but at a better price? And I'll give you a great example. For years, we would do a lot of CTs of the sinuses. They should never be done with an outpatient at a hospital because the hospital is far more expensive. You're paying for bricks and mortar that you don't really need for a scan. I could actually get a scan of the sinuses done for cash for $300 with interpretation. If you did that through your insurance, the charges would be someplace on the order of $800 to $1,000. And if you did it at a hospital, it could be $1,800 to $2,000 under contract. And if you have a copayment that's a percentage, you're going to pay a great deal more. Absolutely talk to the provider, whoever that is, or their staff when you're ordering studies. Find out where you can get what they consider a quality study at a better price within the network so it's covered.
But you're saying, ironically, under certain circumstances, it might be cheaper to pay cash and don't go through your insurance. Does that happen sometimes?
It does, but remember when you do that, it oftentimes doesn't count towards your deductible.
Right,
so if something else is going to happen later on, you're starting from scratch instead of having it added into the deductible, which doesn't seem very fair, but that's the reality. And again, just thinking about this, make sure, 100% sure, before you have anything of cost done, that you are in a network, particularly if you're a PPO patient. You can't just go anywhere you want. Same on an HMO, it's even more restrictive. Knowing what your network is critically important, and accessing care according to your agreement with your insurer is how you make sure that you don't get stuck with a bill that you weren't expecting.
So explain a little bit, you know, for our listeners, this is super important, this in-network versus out-of-network. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So let's break the products down, HMO versus PPO. HMOs, generally, you choose your primary care doctor. Whoever you choose is in a contractual relationship with your health plan or whoever's paying your bills, and we're not talking here about Medi-Cal or Medicare, and that doctor is also contracted through their network with other physicians to cover your medical needs, your specialty needs, et cetera, and hospitals. If you are in an HMO, you often need that primary care doctor to do the referrals. If you make your own appointments and you walk in the door and you're an HMO patient, you may not be able to be seen, or you may have to eat the cost of a visit. So you have to know in an HMO what network you're in, which medical group. They may be all over the county, but they're still a medical group. And you have to make sure whether or not you need a referral. In a PPO setup, which a lot of Californians have, you still have networks. They're generally broader than an HMO network, and they generally cross geographic areas. But you still have to make sure you are using only network providers to get the maximum benefits. You may not need a referral to see a specialist, but you still need to make sure your specialist is in the network, or that you have gone to your health plan and said, I need an out-of-network specialist because nobody in the network can provide what I'm told I need. And then you need to fight with the health plan to get that out-of-network covered as if it was in-network. Many people have heard now about the No Surprises Act that Congress passed. That really deals more with emergency care. It deals with people who are coming into an operating room to assist, or any place else to assist, who aren't in your network. And they used to be able to charge whatever they wanted, and you were on the hook for that. No Surprises Act is trying to address some of those abuses by a handful of physicians and a handful of other types of providers, but it is only partially protective. Your best bet outside of an emergency situation is to know who's in your network. If you're scheduling your own specialty appointments, make sure that you ask the staff when you call, are you in my network? And they're going to ask you, well, tell us exactly what you got, because every one of these health plans, you can't just say, I'm with Blue Cross Blue Shield, because they have multiple products and they have different networks for each product. We always laughed in the office when somebody said, yeah, I have Blue Cross Blue Shield of California, so can I see you? The answer is, well, there is no such thing as Blue Cross Blue Shield of California. They're two different companies. So let's talk about what you really have. Again, like much of healthcare navigation, it's confusing, but it's actually pretty understandable if you just stop to think about what is your product, what are the limits placed on your product. The old days of indemnity insurance are pretty much gone. With Medicaid, you may be in a managed care system here in California, Medi-Cal, and you have to go through the same process as an HMO. There are still a small pocket of fee-for-service, non-HMO Medi-Cal patients. Hard to find providers for them, but you're navigating it by yourself. Any Medi-Cal provider can see you.
So on this surprise billing problem, you know, you go in for a colonoscopy, you know, the doctor doing the colonoscopy is in network. Are you saying that you better ask, is the anesthesiologist who's there in your network or not? Are you saying is it the patient's responsibility to ask those questions?
Yes and no. So under old rules, yeah, you pretty much had to ask. And the way you would do that is actually ask the scheduling person for the physician who's doing the procedure to make sure that you have a covered anesthesiologist, if an anesthesiologist is even involved. And oftentimes for those procedures, they're not now. Just conscious sedation by the provider, by the performer. Mm-hmm. In the No Surprises Act rules, which are still being negotiated, that protects you from having massive out-of-network charges when you were not aware that the anesthesiologist wasn't a member of your network where your colonoscopist was. And that really goes to the emergency room. You go to an emergency room that's in-network. Maybe you're able to choose that. And then you get a bill from the ER doctor because they're not in your network. Those were the kinds of things that the No Surprises Act were trying to address. In my opinion, and the opinion of the medical associations, pretty much nationwide, there was a great deal of overstep in the rules on how to calculate the proper allowed payment, but that's still being remedied right now.
I see. And prescription drugs, you know, are such an expensive part of people's healthcare these days. Are you familiar with this is a for-profit company called GoodRx. I don't have any.
I love GoodRx. I shouldn't say that. Yeah. It sounds like advertising. I use GoodRx for what I need. Yes, very familiar.
Yeah, so I mean, I have no connection to the company either, but I've heard great things. Maybe can you describe, you know, for our listeners how GoodRx or companies like that can help you reduce the cost of your prescription drugs?
Sure. And again, we get into this idea that they're really kind of cash basis. So your plan may have a contract rate for a drug that is higher than what you can pay cash for. GoodRx, which is a free app on your phones, and there are other companies similar to GoodRx. GoodRx, I think, has kind of the dominance in the market. You can actually look up the drug that you need, the strength that you need, and there are two tiers. There's just the free tier. You don't have to pay anybody anything to be a member. You just look it up on the pharmacy you're going to go to, and it will tell you what the cash price at the pharmacy would be for what you need. There's also a membership level, which if you know that you need something on a regular basis that's a little bit more expensive, you pay an annual membership fee to GoodRx, and you actually get a discount off of their discount. On some of the very expensive non-generic products, it still doesn't really make it cost-effective. It brings the cost down. And in many cases, those drugs have no coverage on your plan unless you've failed other medications, and they're still at very high copay. I always love when we get a response from a health plan that says, oh, yeah, that's covered as third tier, and then you look it up, and it's $1,300 a month, and you have to pay $1,200 for it. I go to GoodRx, and you can get it for $600, which is still elaborate and expensive, but a whole lot better than what the insurance company is willing to offer. So for things that are available generic, it is an extremely good way to save money, in many cases cheaper than your copay if you were going through your insurance.
Thanks for joining us for this very interesting discussion on the Fight Back podcast. Please help keep this free podcast available with a $5 gift today on our website at healthcareconsumerrights.org.
Back to negotiating bills here. So if you go into a hospital for some type of medical procedure, you know, with copays and deductibles, your final bill could end up, and if you're there for a week or whatever, your final bill could be still pretty high for a lot of people who are on tight budgets or fixed income. We did a podcast on this a couple years ago, but maybe you can update folks here if you have insights into the hospital side of things. But everything's negotiable is what I had heard in the past, and that if you really are financially strapped, you should push for discounts from the hospital. Is that the case?
Again, let's talk about which kind of patients. Cash patients, absolutely. And if you can, if it's an elective kind of thing, negotiate it before you go. There's lots of room to negotiate. Cash patients, this is one that has always bothered me. You will get a hospital or even a surgery center that say, oh yeah, for cash patients, we'll give you a 50% discount off charges that are 500% of what a health plan might be paying. That's not a discount. That's still a ripoff.
Right.
So on cash, whenever possible, try to negotiate in advance. And yes, the hospital would rather get some fraction of its bill that is still covering its costs than get nothing or have to take a collections action or legal action. And it's very, very difficult and sometimes shameful when they have to take legal action. If you are a PPO patient, again, make sure that for elective things, scheduled things, that the hospital and all their services are within your network. And that's a harder one to negotiate because they've already negotiated your rate down. And if you have a high deductible policy, in some sense, Steve, that was your choice or your employer's choice. And you can always go to your employer and ask for help. But if it was your choice to buy a product with a $2,500 or $5,000 deductible, and unfortunately you have medical needs, it's hard to negotiate that because that was your choice. You paid a lower premium and you gambled or whatever. You decided this was better for you. If you have a high bill, it's still worthwhile trying to negotiate with the finance office. Send a letter to the finance office, send a letter to the administration, CEO of the hospital. But again, if it's already at contract rates and you just happen to not met your deductible up to that point, you could get hit with a pretty high bill. They will at least work with payments for you if they won't negotiate it down. Sometimes you can negotiate it down. I wouldn't put high hopes on someone who has a $2,500 deductible getting a hospital to write it off. And then if you're in an HMO, totally different story, because a lot of times HMOs don't carry deductibles. They don't carry significant copayments. If you get caught with something, work with your health plan. You can do that with the PPO. And something we haven't discussed is appealing some of these charges. Oftentimes, an appeal is important. Internally, you have to exhaust all of the internal appeals processes that are part of your plan, and they're spelled out in your benefits package. You can't just jump to an outside negotiator or a regulator. Once you've exhausted those internally, whether it's because you think the charges were too high or you just think it wasn't properly billed out, there are various levels to go to. So you work with the internal process at the hospital, at the doctor's office. You work with your health plan's appeals process. Then you can work with regulators, the Department of Health, Department of Managed Healthcare Services here, or the Department of Insurance. Those two are the regulators in California. And sometimes you go to third-party external review, which may be requested by you, the patient, or it might be requested by the provider, by the physician, either pre-service or post-service. So there are various places you can go to try to fight for either a fight against the denial of services or a denial of payment or what you believe to be an improper billing. And I have to tell you, personally, from a physician standpoint, it is worth going through that effort if you think that the plan is mistreating you in not allowing a service or not paying appropriately for a service.
Yes. You know, when I was insurance commissioner here in California, I did have good success at guiding consumers to utilize these independent medical reviews, these IMRs. So I had some pretty good experience with it, you know, as insurance commissioner, but do you have experience yourself with patients who've been denied a service that a doctor wants to prescribe, you know, and I think there's a 30-day clock, something like that on these IMRs, and these IMRs are evaluated by independent physicians. You know, what's your experience with those?
Yeah, I have to tell you, I've been an advocate for patients for a long time, and I've used IMR occasionally when I finally couldn't get a health plan to understand. But again, even as a physician, I have to go through the other process. So let's talk about a couple of different scenarios. Prior authorization for a service. Horrible system that we're living in. When the doc says, I think you need to have X, the doc applies for approval. The plan says no. And most of the time that I've gotten no's over the years, it was because I was asking for my favorite example. I was asking for an MRI scan of the head for a person who had every sign of something called an acoustic neuroma, a small tumor on the nerve between the ear and the brain that was causing specific problems. I was turned down. I appealed. I was turned down. I asked for a like specialty review, meaning someone who understands what I'm doing. Instead, I was put on the phone with a retired gynecologist in Ohio, to whom I had to explain what an acoustic neuroma was. And finally, I said, I need an ENT, a radiologist, or a neurologist, neurosurgeon, and got the thing approved. But that took hours on the phone, and it's ridiculous to have to go through that. I didn't go to IMR there. I finally was able to tackle it internally. Going through the Department of Managed Healthcare, going through the Department of Insurance, I think they're pretty effective in finding the right route. My complaint would only be that it's sometimes hard for either the patient or the physician to get to the point within those regulators where we get the answers that we need. IMR is a last resort, quite frankly, and that's part of another process, which is an independent dispute resolution where you've now had a service and the plan says, we're only going to pay 20% of what you thought you were going to get paid. And the patient goes, well, wait a minute, and then I have to eat the rest. Or the doctor says, that's not fair. And then you go to a dispute resolution process, which is somewhat effective. California passed some laws a little while ago. Initially, that process didn't work, and it was always favoring the health plans. It seems to have been shifting and working a little bit better now, which is what's hoped for in things like the No Surprises Act. But bottom line, Steve, you have to be your own advocate. And hopefully your physician will be your advocate as well. There are plans that do not let the physician appeal a denial. or an underpayment. They ask that the patient does that, which is kind of absurd because the patient doesn't have the background to really do that. But if your physician asks your help, help them. If you need help of the physician, ask them for help. Between the two of you working with each other, you can often beat the unreasonable denials and the unreasonable underpayment or post-service denials.
To what extent, Ted, do insurance companies just drive you crazy in the sense of all the different, you know, patients that you're helping on a month-by-month basis? How many of them fall into the bucket of the insurance companies are just getting in your way of doing medically necessary work?
Daily. It's not the number of patients. It's the number of hours spent on the one or two a day that you have to deal with. And it's primarily things like automated denials for services or layers of denial to get to what you believe the patient needs. Most of it, in my experience, dealt with imaging studies. Some of it dealt with surgeries. Oftentimes, the surgery issues were post-service. They'd approve the surgery, and then they would deny parts of the surgery after the fact. But getting simple things that you meet all the guidelines for. Look, I was a medical director for years for a multi-specialty group of over 300 doctors. I kind of learned the rules. So when somebody says, no, you can't have this X-ray or MRI done, I raise my ire and say, if I didn't think it qualified, I wouldn't have asked.
Right.
And yet my staff has to spend time with secretaries asking for more and more information, some of it now online, and then you get denial and you have to call and you wait forever for a call back. My favorite thing is they only call you back when you're seeing patients or when I was in the operating room. It's you can't even schedule a time. The health plan will say, give me a four-hour window where our people can call you. And I say, no, give me a one-hour window during my lunchtime. Your guys are sitting in front of a computer screen. I'm seeing patients. It is I would say after EMR, electronic health records, it's probably the second most annoying bane of existence in medicine is the entire process of dealing with health plans.
How many physicians are saying, I just have had enough, you know, and they're retiring, or is there any signs that medical schools are having a harder time recruiting people, or are doctors moving to the Kaisers of the world so they don't have to deal with insurance companies? I'm just curious how frustrated is the profession out there.
The frustrations are immense. Early retirements, even before COVID, were starting to show up, and with COVID, it accelerated it. If in terms of the new physicians coming out of training, the desire is no longer to be an independent physician. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, we're down to 26% of America's physicians are now independent private practice physicians. That's a dramatic decline. And it's falling continually. It will continue to fall because the cost of running a practice, the hassles of running a practice without a main back office, they're just driving people out of practice, period. The new physicians coming into practice are more and more seeking employment positions. And it's not just Permanente. Permanente is one place that they can go. There are lots of large groups now that are owned by hospitals or outside of California, owned by corporations. California has a bar on some of that. The new docs want to work given hours. If they're on call, they don't want to work the next day. The whole paradigm has changed. It impacts the ability to cover for the patients who need services because we really haven't expanded much on the number of doctors graduating and getting residencies. So the fewer patients, the fewer hours a physician works, the tighter access to care has become. And particularly in primary care, it's reached breaking points and will continue to get worse. There is a paradigm shift, and it has a lot to do with people just not wanting to do the business of medicine anymore. It's very difficult.
Well, a little scary, really. I wanted to also ask you about second opinions, Dr. Mazur. Do you recommend that in the spirit of buyer beware and patients need to take care of their own medical situation at the end of the day, do you recommend that patients should boldly ask for second opinions on any kind of serious procedure that might be prescribed?
Absolutely, 100%. Unless you already understand how things are and you believe that what the first physician is telling you is the right thing to do, never hesitate to ask for a second opinion. Here's been my motto. A patient says, you know, doc, I want to get a second opinion. I say, go for it. Get back to me. Call me with any questions. Do not feel embarrassed for asking for a second opinion. You need to be assured that what I'm recommending is what is reasonable and what you want. And maybe somebody has a different idea. And then you get back into the second opinion in network, out of network kind of stuff, which we could talk about. But you should never hesitate. If you're uncertain when the doctor says, I need you to do this, get a second opinion. Ask your primary care physician or ask the specialist, who would you go to for another opinion? And don't go to somebody in the same practice. Find somebody else, same specialty, but not in the same practice.
Right. And does your insurance usually cover the cost of a second opinion?
So that's a great question. Yes, if it's a simple second opinion, you run into more problems when the second opinion wants to repeat studies. And they're going to say, well, you just had this study done 3 months ago by Dr. Smith, and now Dr. X wants you to do it again. That's a problem. In terms of just getting into another physician's office, generally second opinions aren't an issue. It can become an issue if you have a very, very narrow network and you have something very unique, because there may only be one practice in that network, particularly in an HMO, that has what you need as a service. But at least in California, and I'm sure elsewhere in the country, there are laws that say if the plan can't give you a second opinion in network, it must pay for a second opinion out of network. And I can remember sitting across the table from health plans 25 years ago and demanding that that be part of the law. You need to be able to be assured that you are comfortable moving forward with a major medical intervention, and second opinions play a key role in that.
Right. Also, I wanted to ask you about these folks out there that are called patient advocates. You know, you have to get a certificate, you know, you got to get trained to become, you know, a certified patient advocate. I don't know if you're familiar with these, but sometimes, you know, retired nurses, that kind of thing. But if you're about to go into the hospital with a family member or your own treatment, and it's a complicated, you know, long stay in that hospital, potentially, do you recommend that families consider hiring patient advocates who will go in there with you to help, you know, fight for the best treatment and care while you're in the hospital?
I think it's a very variable thing, Steve. If you've got a complex issue and you're not savvy on medical things and feel like you need somebody outside of the family who might be a lot more savvy, it's not a bad idea. And it may just be to get things started so that you understand what's happening. It may be after the fact, after hospitalization and patient is not doing well, and the patient's not doing well, you may need somebody to come in and help you through the process or help the family through the process. I don't see it being utilized that much. I see it being utilized sometimes after the fact. Some of the things we've just talked about, you get somebody who reviews the bills and says, well, here's what you should fight. Here's what should have been done in terms of coding and billing. But it does have its place. I'm not too comfortable yet that a lot of the advocates who are doing this are effective and are well-trained. There are certainly some who are, but a lot of people have just kind of dropped into this sphere and said, hey, let me help you out, and they bill for it, and it's not going to be a covered benefit. I don't think anybody pays for that service.
I see. Quick question, Ted, then, you know, before we wrap up here on COVID, I mean, as a ears, nose, and throat specialist, you must be exhausted dealing with COVID patients over the last few years. And how's that gone for you? Where do you see the pandemic right now? Are we at the tail end? What's your outlook?
I think we will be in the endemic stage for quite some time. I think we're towards the tail end of the pandemic, unless we get a wild mutant, which is always possible. But so far, that has not really happened. We've had some surges, but less severe disease. I'm not hopeful that we will say, oh, we're done with COVID anytime soon. The way this virus is mutating into various forms, I think we're looking at a protracted illness of less severity than what we experienced in the first 2 years. So no, I don't think it's going away. Will it become the future of influenza? It's possible, but we've seen other types of flus and other types of viral infections pretty much disappear and then sporadically show their heads with a, you know, a little local endemic infection rate, and then it goes away again. You know, Spanish influenza and bird flu and things like that that people have talked about. But I'm not hopeful that we're past COVID. I just think we have finally gotten to the point where there's reasonable immunity, or at least immunity to severe disease. We have much better treatments, and there will be continuation of improvements on treatments, and we will deal with it like we deal with chronic infection already in other aspects of viral illness. It's impacted the healthcare delivery system dramatically. It's pushed telemedicine to the fore, and we are still waiting to see whether people will push to stay with telemedicine, whether payers will pay for telemedicine, including federal payers, going forward. So far, people are not so sure it's going to be a permanent covered benefit. It's pushed people out of practice, particularly, again, the primary care, small practice situation. People went insolvent. They may not want to come back, or they've had to join larger groups, which in essence causes increase in prices. That's what studies have shown over and over again as consolidation occurs. So it's changing the face of the practice of medicine and the access to medical care pretty dramatically, and it will continue to do so over the next year or two, and then we'll see what's left at the back end.
Have you had personally some good experience with telemedicine? You know, I know some elderly folks that really appreciate being able just to Zoom in to talk to their doctor rather than having to physically, you know, go there. Has that worked out for you and your patients?
Well, you know what? Telemedicine is perfect for following chronic disease, people who can go get labs, or even now home equipment to monitor things. You can do an EKG on your phone. It's harder for some specialties. Obviously, you can't do surgery by telemedicine. It's rather difficult for someone like myself to look down somebody's throat beyond the back of their tonsils with telemedicine. We did some of that at the beginning of this when the offices were pretty much vacant. It certainly has its place in primary care, but it is not a substitute for a full examination. And if your health condition is changing, you probably need to do more than discuss it on telemedicine. For people who are trying not to take time off from work, trying not to find a babysitter for their kids at home or drag kids into the doctor's office, for follow-up care on something that is non-touch requiring, you know, again, you can't take sutures out, but you can certainly look at a scar that's healing properly or improperly on telemedicine. So it has a marvelous place both for convenience and for improving access. But it has its limitations as well.
Right. And final question here. So for listeners who want to educate themselves on how to navigate, you know, this complex healthcare system, you know, the billing, you know, co-pays, deductibles, in-network, out-of-network, I think part of your message is, you know, consumers have to educate themselves and ask the right questions. How do you get started? What advice do you have, you know, for consumers to arm themselves with the right information?
Well, as we get towards the September-October period and people are looking at whether they're going to change health plans through their employer or otherwise, you can easily read online what the differences are between preferred provider organization, PPO products, HMO products. You can call a health plan and ask them to describe this for you. Consumer lines sometimes back up for hours, unfortunately. I think it's worse for physicians. They don't want to talk to us. But if you're trying to do customer service and they want to maintain you as an insured, then they will generally help you through this. Ask your physicians, ask their staff, their office managers can often give you the answers to what are the pros and cons of your different options that you can choose from. But most importantly, when you get a plan, whether it's through HR or you're doing this on your own, you will have a summary statement of your benefits and then a detailed statement of your benefits. Take the time to at least read the summary, and what you don't understand, call the plan and ask, what does this mean? Do I have to pay every time I go to the doctor for my copay before and after I've reached my deductible? What services don't require copay? And there are a lot of preventive services that don't go to your deductible and don't require copayments. There's women's health things. There are colonoscopies that are covered before deductibles. It's a lot of information, but it's really not that hard to get the basics down. And when you are visiting the physician and the physician is ordering studies or suggesting surgeries, ask the questions. What's covered? What's not? Now, something that's relatively new, you can go online to your health plan and you can actually punch in the services that the doctor is recommending and find out what your estimated costs are. Most of the major health plans have that available to you. So take the time and log in. Get it, you know, make sure that you have a password to get in there because it's private information, and find out. And they will actually, in some cases, tell you how much it's going to cost you out of pocket, depending upon which facility you go to. There's lots of ways of learning about it, but nothing is going to happen overnight. It is a caveat emptor, consumer beware, but more than consumer beware, consumer educate yourself. Understand the product that you have purchased or have chosen with your employer so that you are not surprised at the back end, and understand what the terms deductible and co-payment and maximum out-of-pocket mean, so that when you're navigating, you're going in prepared.
Great advice. Dr. Ted Mazur, thank you so much for being on our podcast today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to today's Fight Back podcast. Our mission is to provide you with the healthcare resources and information in a refreshing and interesting format. I also want to thank Dr. Mazur for his great insights into how consumers can positively impact the costs of their healthcare. For more information, please visit our website at www.healthcareconsumerrights.org. While on our website, you can check out additional podcasts or access more information and resources to help you navigate our healthcare system and get the care you deserve. We also welcome your input and topic ideas that we can use on our future podcasts. This is Steve Poizner, and this is Fight Back, a podcast by the Healthcare Consumer Rights Foundation. Thanks for listening. I look forward to our next podcast. Talk with you soon.
We hope you enjoyed the Fight Back podcast today. This is a free podcast available to provide consumers with quality information to help you fight for the healthcare you deserve. We are brought to you by listener supporters. Please consider making a $5 gift on our website, healthcareconsumerrights.org, to help keep Fight Back available for all listeners.